accession number 20094, reel 8.
George Leicester, reel 8.
Right, we sailed from Liverpool. Before sailing, by the way, we also embarked a lot of Wrens from Admiralty, Wren officers and ordinary Wrens. These Wrens were telegraphist Wrens, and they were used to transcribing and typing from the Morse as delivered by undulator tapes, and the cipher officers were obviously there for cipher encoding. Life was quite serene. We were all wondering where the hell we were going. We thought, well, it can't be to a really hectic operation because of the women, the ladies on board. It can't be, we can't be doing an invasion or anything like that, because we had army, RAF, army people turned up as well, by the way. And so we sailed. In the Bisky, it was very rough, and in our position forward on the Franconia, it was pretty horrible. But I'll always admire the way the girls kept going, in spite of being very ill. They still stuck to it and kept on, you know, doing their job. They were fantastic. Well, those who had been to sea before and in that area for there, we knew roughly by the position of the sun and what a course we were taking by the time of the day. And when we turned to sail due east and went through the Straits of Gib at night time and were in the Med the following day, we were all looking to forward, oh, well, we must be going to Malta or something like it. And we... thing of all the runs ashore and introduce the girls, you know, to Malta, but no, we didn't go to Malta. In fact, just as just after passing Malta, we're all issued with civilian clothing, and all military gear, all uniforms, everything had to be stowed out of sight, nothing to be seen. And then we were told that we would be going through the Dardanelles and the Bosphorus into the Black Sea. And we were going to Yalta. We were going to Sevastopol. We were also issued with little passes issued by the War Cabinet. I've still got mine. Issued by the Office of the War Cabinet, January 1945. British delegation. The Navy ones had a dark blue stripe diagonally across it. The Army had a red diagonal stripe on it. And the Air Force a light blue stripe diagonally across it. And on it was your name, your rank, and the position on your ship, and then the position of the ship. These were the delegation passes. Mine was number 153, and I say I still got that one. Number 153, and I still got it. So we pulled in. So then Commander Dorney told us that we were the communication staff for a big three conference that was going to be held. Ostensibly, it was going to be held on board the Franconia initially, if the Russians couldn't have got the Yalta conference rooms in order again, because a lot of work had gone on to conference suites and all the rest of it, like on board the ship, and this is why the addition of a lot of the Marines were there as servants, officer servants and things like that, should the conference take on board the ship. But it didn't. The Russians managed to get their conference room sorted out at Lividia Palace, and I was one of those that had to go up to the conference rooms, and we installed a small transceiver. Funny enough, it was the same as the transceiver that I operated on the Captain Class Riggers, the Collins TCS transceiver. We had one in the conference room and one back at on board the ship in the receiving office on board the ship. This was an emergency link. Most of the traffic generated at the conference, or news or synopsis that Churchill wanted for, during the conference, would come through normal there. It would be decoded, deciphered, then taken up to the conference room by courier, by courier for him to read. But if during the conference he was asked a question, he wanted an answer straight away, he would say, he would ask the question what he wanted, it would be enciphered up on the spot, it would be given to either myself or the three operators in the P-Hotel. We worked three watches around the clock. And given to either the railroad on watch or the P-Hotel, given to us to transmit back to the ship. As it's been received in the ship, it has been automatically sent straight through to Admiralty. Now, it might be because of there, it could have been typed up on a Morse, on the Morse sender tape, as it's been received, as the chap was receiving it, so the remedy there, you know, typing up there. When the message was finished, straight through, high speed Morse to Admiralty. It carried a special operating group, and when the reply came, that would automatically be sent on by direct line to the operator there, to me or whoever's on watch there, transcribed, given to the cipher officer who would decode it and give it to Churchill, or give it to General Ismay or his chief of staff or whoever there to give to Churchill. And that was our purpose. And of course, when the big three stopped speaking, and then it got down to the nitty gritty, the nuts and bolts of the agreements, and all the chiefs of staffs and the aides were sitting there thrashing out what had been agreed and how it was going to be implemented and all the rest of it. We closed down that direct link because it was no longer required. No, everything was carried out from the ship then. But I never saw Stalin, never saw him. I saw Roosevelt once. And he was a very, very frail old man in a wheelchair, being pushed along by quite a small tour. I think it was a colonel there. And someone said later that was Roosevelt's son. I'm not quite certain. I can't vouch for that, but he looked very ill indeed. And I often think that possibly the strain of that conference was instrumental in helped him on his way, because he died only 2 months later, didn't he, before the war finished. And, we finished up back on board the Franconia. Lots of traffic with Admiralty. And we went on a sightseeing tour of Sevastopol. I'd say a sightseeing tour. There were no buildings. Sevastopol had been under... It was under terrific bombardment by the Germans before they captured it. It was then under terrific bombardment by the Russians when they tried to regain it. So, over a period of 2.5 years, it was really being bombed and shattered every day. And there was nothing left. The inhabitants, which mainly comprised very old men, women, and little children. They were ambling around, and you could see that they hadn't had the benefit of any washing facilities, or really good washing facilities, for a long, long while. You could see that. And their shoes were masses and masses of rags bound up. Find a bit of rag, wrap around the feet, tie it, there was a bit of string. They were all these like quilted type coats. That's what they were wearing. And I was quite surprised when a big luxury car pulled up, and out stepped a character. You thought he'd come out from one of the from an opera. He was very smartly dressed, clean-shaven, like a powder blue uniform, no insignia on it, just a powder blue uniform with some buttons on it. A lovely white astrakhan hat. I'd love to have pinched it, with a big red star on it. Nice big leather jack boots, you know. And I said to the interpreter, I said, "Who's he?" And he said, "Oh," and she said, "That's a local commissar." And I said, "Well," I said, "I thought everybody was supposed to be equal in Russia." And she didn't answer me. She just walked away, and she never came near me for the rest of the for the rest of the trip. We went up to the Russian lines on the perimeters, and there we met the Russian soldiers there. They were great bonhomie. Everyone seemed to have a bottle of vodka, so we imbibed, and we were swapping our cap tallies, HMS cap tallies, for their little red star badges that they had in their caps. And then we had to swap them all back again because the officer didn't like it. He said, "No, we wouldn't let." One of the Russian officers, he made us change it all back again. And so that the Yalta Conference, Churchill came on board the Franconia, and stayed a couple of days before flying off to Parsons New. The reason for the RAF people, by the way, the Churchill flew in to a special airstrip, and the RAF were the ground controllers and the fitters and the maintenance people for the aircraft, when it arrived, he and the Entridge, and he flew out, and I think from there he went to Cairo. I'm not quite certain, but I know he didn't fly straight back to UK. And he made a speech on board the ship, thanked us all, everything else. People that we saw mostly up the conference room was General Ismay and Anthony Eden on occasion, isn't that? And Anthony Eden, but General Ismay was I think he was Churchill's senior aide, and he was always in to see us. Then we sailed back, we left Sevastopol. Came back down through, put into Malta. It was only shore leave one day. It was a rotten day, and the first time I've known snow in Malta. We brought it. I think we dragged this cloud with us all the way down from Sevastopol, because we left there in a raging blizzard. Incidentally, we changed, when we got into the Black Sea, we changed back into uniforms. When we left Sevastopol, we had to hand all these civilian clothes in. In actual fact, I didn't know, but about 8 months later, that would become one of the standard demob suits, the grey chalk stripe suits that they used for demob. We didn't know it was that close. But we got to Malta, and then from there we came back to the UK, and I went back to Petersfield. The Petersfield was overflowing then, and so they sent me down to Collingwood, I did a short few weeks there doing morse instruction for wrens in the signal section at Collingwood at the time. Then I got drafted to HMS Boxer. She was a former tank landing ship, a British-built tank landing ship, which had taken part in the Anzio landings, actually. But they brought her back to UK and they converted her into a fighter direction ship. And what an apparition she was. Internally, all the tank decks have been turned into operations rooms, plotting rooms, what have you. There's no real weight in there. They put four big masts on her, and on the just in front of the four masts was a big American radar, which is under cover of a massive big radome. You could not see forward from the bridge. You had to go to the wings of the bridge to see ahead this big radome. I was the advance party for commissioning, and as such, I loved working up in the upper loft, and I helped rig. I was made up to lead and tell by this time, and helped to rig most of the double tiers on board the Boxer, both the receiving and the transmitting ones. We sailed. Well, we went out for sea trials first of all. But we only got the far as the mouth of the Mersey. This was shows we were being converted into at Birkenhead. Only got as far as the mouth of the Mersey, and in the gentle swell, the ship was rolling so heavily that we had to come back. And the next 3 days, I spent putting pig iron down in the bilges to give us some stability. We sailed for exercises of operating from Douglas with the RAF from Jerby in the Isle of Man. One amusing thing that happened one day was myself and Leantel Hawkins, His Majesty the King was flying from England to Ireland, and they wanted as many of the air sea rescue launches out as possible, stationed all en route. They had one spare one in the Isle of Man at Douglas, but they didn't have any operators, so Leantel Hawkins, myself, we were detailed off to go out for this one day on this air sea rescue launch to go on station. As whilst on there, we come across a mine which had broken adrift. We didn't have anything at all to get rid of. The captain of the Air Force sergeant, who was the captain of this SE rescue launch, he didn't like the idea of getting too close, and he manoeuvred slowly away from it, and a ship appeared in the distance, so I got on the oldest and flashed her up and told her the mine over, there's a mine, you know, and everything else, and we got away and left them to it. I think they sunk it. It didn't blow up, though. They couldn't have hit one of the horns, you know. It must have just punctured a few holes in it and it sank. From there, we went up to Greenock. I received the news that my brother, who was staying in the army, who used to be in the commandos, was seriously ill in Bobbin Hospital, and in fact the person who brought the news on board was a friend of mine, brother, because my brother was billeted with him when he was in the commandos at Largs. And he said to the captain, is there any chance of him getting any compassionate leave? And he said, no way. He said, it's a key rating on board this ship, and we're sailing this afternoon. There's no way I can get a relief for him. So we sailed from Greenock, and I got the telegram just before we got to Malta, so that my brother had died in Bovington Hospital. We were on the way to the Far East. Ostensibly to be one of the fighter direction ships during the invasion of Japan. Though most of the crew looked upon this as a certain amount of trepidation, because our main armament was 2 4-barrel pom-poms. And we had some Oerlikons, but because of the masses of aerials and on the ship, they had restriction rails around them for their arc of fire, and it has to be flying very low for it to be effective. And the news was around then that the kamikazes were operating out in the Pacific, and we always thought a Japanese kamikaze, that looks a nice plum target down there. We didn't fancy our chances much. But just as we got to Malta, the atom bomb at Hiroshima was dropped. And then the one at I think it was 2 or 3 days later, the one at Nagasaki. And then, of course, there was no need for any invasion of Japan, because the Japanese decided to give in. So we stayed at Malta. We did a few flight trials and tests and things with the RAF. And we came back to the UK in the end of October, beginning of November. By this time, most of the people who were hostilities only in for the war, were all busy looking at their demob numbers and things like that. And it was realised that there were a lot of people abroad who really need to be demobbed. And so we continue our service ratings. We're under no illusion that our very short commission that we just completed was no way. Was that going to be the last one? That very soon that we'd be shipped out. And I left the Boxer just around about Christmas time. And shortly after that, I was drafted out to the Far East via Colombo. And it was, I was at a transit camp at Colombo, HMS Manara. It was communication ratings only, about 30 miles from Colombo. There we, the powers to be had decided that it's about time the Royal Navy telegraphists got up modern and started using communication typewriters instead of receiving signals with a pencil. And so we all had to take a touch typing course to receive Morse at 30 words a minute, to pass out, to receive Morse at 30 words a minute, and to copy type at 40. This was a 6-week course. Unfortunately, they did not have any communication typewriters for us to practice on, and we had rotten old things like 1914 Underwoods and Imperials and things like that to try and learned the touch type Morson. Glad to say we managed and we all passed the examinations. At this time, two Abney Fleet orders came out. One was cancelled almost immediately, and that was one which stated that any continuous service rating who joined as a boy and who whose only method to get to the Navy was to sign on for 12 years from the age of 18 could transfer to hostilities only. In other words, to take a demob as if he'd been called up. That was a very short-lived AFO because so many people put in to leave that that was cancelled. I think it was cancelled within a week. In fact, in some areas, it was not even promulgated. It never got out. The other one was more to affect me was the fact that it was known during the war, the great technological advances of equipment in the Navy. Well, you just couldn't hear. You had radar, which you never had before the war. You had sophisticated radio equipment. And all these were maintained by radio mechanics and radar mechanics who had been recruited during the war. They'd gone along to universities and other people, taken them in, right, made them a petty officer, sent them to sea as a radio or radar mechanic. These people were now going to leave the service. So here you had a modern day Navy going around with lots of high-tech equipment and virtually nobody to maintain it. So this AFO stated that any leading to Lakefist or above continuous service who had received technical training as a boy, which most of us had, could, if they wanted, could opt to transfer to a newly formed electrical branch of the Royal Navy and become radio electricians. It also said in the FO that in future the communication side would be just be for operating only. Now, I was always very interested in the technical side of things, so I decided to change over. And I was drafted. They said we would send you home as soon as possible to do a 9-month conversion course into your new branch. This AFO came out in May 1946. Suffice to say, I started my conversion course in October 1949. in the meantime, I've been drafted up to from Ceylon, or Sri Lanka as it's called now, via Singapore to Hong Kong, to Stonecutters, the Royal Naval Wireless Station at Stonecutters Island, RNWT station.